Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is side two of tape 414, November the 9th, 1979. I'm laughing because on the side of the tape, Mae Brussel, the researcher, is going to be maybe a movie star after all. Not a star, but we made a movie in Hollywood several years ago. Those of you that have had these tapes a long time remember those. If not, you can get the past cassettes. They're number 275. This is in June of 1977. I went to Los Angeles to make a movie called The Howard Hughes Mystery. And then I did a follow-up of the tape on October of in 77, and another one in December of 77, asking to exhume the body in Houston, Texas, that wasn't Howard Hughes. And we're getting back into the exhuming of Hughes at a time when there's articles out about exhuming Lee Harvey Oswald. And also I have some more to say about Adolf Hitler. Those are the three that I would really like to expose and study: the getaway of Hitler and the transfer of the body, the getaway of Lee Harvey Oswald, and the killing of Howard Hughes earlier and taking over the empire. And now they all seem to be breaking in the news this week, and it's really funny the way they came together. I got a call from Manuel Zecina. He made that movie. The movie was made originally in 1977, as I say, and there was an article June 28th in a midnight exclusive interview, and it has an interview with Broderick Crawford, who's in the movie, and Cameron Mitchell, and there's a gentleman that plays Howard Hughes, and there are scenes where Hughes is supposed to be in Las Vegas or up in Canada and traveling around. And then I open the movie with another actor who's an older man who was in Love Boat. I never watched this series, so I don't even remember his name. We shot scenes together where we're in a projection room, and as the movie of Howard Hughes' life unfolds, I interrupt it, and first I introduce myself as a researcher, and then I interrupt the scenes and explain, no, this isn't the way it happened. There was no Howard Hughes in Nevada at all. Nobody saw him there. He was never there. And then they go on and do some more scenes, and they talk about the death of Hughes. And I said, no, he's not buried. He wasn't in Mexico. He is not in that grave in Texas. There's an unmarked grave, and Vance Cooper is in the grave. And then there's a scene about fingerprinting Howard Hughes, and I show on the screen my correspondence with the FBI director at the time, Clarence Kelly, that he didn't get the accurate fingerprints of Howard Hughes, and I challenged those fingerprints. So this movie was made, and people from the Summa Corporation, the Hughes organization, got to Manuel Zecina at one time, and one-third of the filming that I did was taken away when it was sent to the lab. It was put in some cans and taken off to the color lab, and we all went out to dinner, late lunch at the end of the filming, and I had this psychic weird feeling it was never going to be developed, and a lot of it was taken. Then we came down and we filmed it again, and the film never was, parts of it were there, most of it was there, but it was never put out, and Manuel's had it in the can, literally, for this past year, and he called me this week. Cameron Mitchell, the actor, phoned him that Jim Bacon, who's a close personal friend of Howard Hughes, had an article in the Los Angeles Examiner this week that somebody, it's this Brooks Randall, who was the double of Hughes, the face double, had contacted him and said, Jim, you and I are the only two that really knows what went on with the Howard Hughes case. Now, this is an article in the Los Angeles Examiner this last week, and he said, you know that Brooks Randall is buried in that grave in Texas. It's not Howard, and that Howard has been dead for a long time, and that the FBI didn't fingerprint, they didn't compare the body in Texas to the police records. Howard Hughes had run over a man in Los Angeles, and that was very nicely covered up, but they did fingerprint him. That's as far as they got. And those fingerprints don't match the body that's buried in Houston, Texas. Those of you who know me personally know I have a collection of T-shirts with various slogans on them, and one of my favorite is Exhume Vance Cooper, and it has the date 4-5-76. Houston, Texas. Some people say, who is Vance Cooper? And some people just laugh, and I reply, that's Howard Hughes. Well, Manuel called, he was meeting with Jim Bacon and Brooks Randall this week, and said to Brooks, hey, we already have that film in the can. We have a correspondence with Clarence Kelly. We have Mae Brussel talking about Vance Cooper. So it seems that the film will be going out. As a matter of fact, a year ago this last fall, I think he wanted me to go to the Cannes Film Festival with that film. I didn't think it was that good a film, really. If he had known how hot the material was, I could have worked with them from the beginning. But I met them when the film was really the story of Howard Hughes, and then Manuel inserted these scenes because he thought it made a better movie, which it does. But we didn't go to Cannes with it, and it will be out eventually. It's coming now, and he's excited. So in the next few months, you may see Mae Bressel as a researcher playing myself. There was an article this last summer in 1979 apropos of this case. The Summa Corporation, which is the Howard Hughes family organization now, filed a $230 million lawsuit against 13 of Howard's personal aides and doctors. And what they claim is in the lawsuits against Chester Davis, the New York attorney, Bill Gay, he was the head of the Summa organization. He started out as a chauffeur driving the starlets like Terry Moore to their dance classes. He became the head of the Summa Corporation and Howard's aides, and he had three physicians. And the lawsuit claims that shortly after Hughes moved to Las Vegas in 1966, the defendants conspired to take over his huge holdings by deceiving Howard Hughes, and that they began to drug him and make him a reclusive and continue his mental and physical infirmities. Now, 1966 is the year that these people took over the Summa Corporation. Howard went from the Beverly Hills Hotel. He stayed there in 1957 to 1966 and was beginning to get drugged and zonked out of his head and was seen crazy enough and drugged enough so that it would be believable later that he did have a breakdown. But there was no Howard Hughes in Las Vegas, and people, the aides and doctors, were writing the names. And the split was when he went to Boston, to a hospital in Boston in 1966. These people in this lawsuit have been charged with controlling him since that date, which I think was important. They charged that Chester Davis and Gay fraudulently obtained proxies from Howard Hughes in 1970 that gave them control over Howard Hughes' Nevada property. Well, that's true, they fraudulently did, because there was no Howard Hughes and there was a lot of forgery, and they did take over the empire, and the lawsuit claims that they had to plan to control the huge empire. This probably is the most gross case of a kidnapping that runs into the billions, and this is a $230 million lawsuit, and for some reason or other, as of yet, the Summa Corporation, the relatives of Howard Hughes, have not gone into the fact of exhuming that grave, but we did on a tape. I made a tape when I was on KLRB that's available. It was a broadcast on a lawsuit filed by Douglas Wallace as an attorney to exhume the body in Houston, Texas, because it wasn't Howard Hughes. So I'll keep you up on the movie, but I'm laughing. It's finally going to come. It's been 2 years, but everything has its day and its time, and so it will be coming out. You must admit I have a lot of patience for these things. I can wait years and years for a story, and something happens, and then I just sit back, and I don't expect the earth to open or great things to come. But in its own time, all of these stories do come out, and they're important, and they seep into the people's consciousness one way or the other. There's a new book out called The Murder of Rudolf Hess by W. U. Thomas, and it's about the author believes that Hess was murdered. I don't see any reason to believe that he would be murdered. Maybe he escaped, or maybe he does believe that he was. But the important thing about this book is that he claims that the person in Spandau Prison is a double, that the man who wrote this book is a surgeon. He twice examined him, that he didn't have wounds from the first war, and that there had been a replacement here, and that the man in prison, who is now home now, I think, with his family, or sick in a hospital, is not Rudolf Hess, the famous Nazi that flew out of Germany in May of 1941 and went over to England. He tried to coax Great Britain to go to war with the Soviet Union instead of with Germany. And the double, this is what the doctor claims, is in prison, I guess to appease, I think the motive would be to appease the Soviet Union and the world that Nazis do get punished. But on Dick Cavett's show, he had an interview with the author of this book, W.U. Thomas, and he was talking about Hess, and the author went on to say, well, there are very many doubles in history, the famous doubles. He said Winston Churchill had a double and Adolf Hitler had a double. And then they got into the subject of you, Trevor Roper, who's been putting down the Hess double book, and asked Mr. Thomas, Dick Cavett asked him, well, why is he putting you down? And he said, well, you, Trevor Roper, is just writing what the British want. He works for the British service. He dances to the tune, whoever pays the piper, you know, he dances to whatever they want. And Dick Cavett said, "Do you mean to tell me that Adolf Hitler is alive?" And he went on to say that you, Trevor Roper, is no historian, that he lies for the British. He's not an authentic historian. And he blasted you, Trevor Roper. He said, "I don't take him seriously. He put down my book, but he's pomp without circumstances." These are some of the quotations. And that he as much as says that you, Trevor Roper, is paid by the British to say what the British wanted, and that he falsified the story of the bunker and implied about the Adolf Hitler story. And those of you that have the tape or want to get that back tape, this goes to July 1978, a year and a few months back. I did a tape, part of it was a book, Who Killed Hitler? Another book, Hitler is Alive, a large magazine article. And then I have the references of Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment, and the introduction was written by you, Trevor Roper. And I've claimed that Mark Lane, the assassination researcher, has covered up the Nazis and the conspiratorial angles to the Kennedy assassination, stayed on Dealey Plaza, and got the notoriety as a researcher, but hid the truth. And you, Trevor Roper, is a historian and a researcher, but hides the truth and wrote the introduction for Mark Lane's book. But to hear Mr. U. Thomas blast U. Trevor Roper and then get into the subject of Adolf Hitler was very interesting, because many of you say, "Oh, May, we know that this conspiracy happened and that, but you've gone too far, or you've gone too far on alternative three, or you just stretch out on a limb." I don't think I'm going too far, and I think if you study closely the books and articles and more information coming out, two sources last week were talking to me about Adolf Hitler. And he's 89, he'll be 90 in April, but there's a lot of 90-year-olds around, a vegetarian in good health down in Antarctica. It's possible that he is in Switzerland, where I was told he was, at the sanitarium in Switzerland. But here was a Dick Cavett show with this author referring to the errors of a historian who was solely responsible for the story that Hitler was burned. And he doesn't believe it. He said that on the show and suggested that, yes, indeed, Hitler, like Rudolf Hess, was another famous double. He came right out and said that and suggested also the possibility that Hitler was alive. Midnight Globe has an article this week, November the 13th, 1979, with the various faces of Lee Harvey Oswald and the Michael Eddowes story about the doubles. But what they do have on the back of the Globe also is an article, Whose Grave? And it says, "There may be nobody in his grave," says a top Texas attorney. And it goes into an attorney in Fort Worth by the name of Jerry Pittman, who prints in the Midnight Globe the minutes of the Warren Commission meeting about removing the body of Lee Harvey Oswald and cremating it. Now, I've been trying to get that story in the Globe for the last 5 years. I've written many articles for them. And the man who took my articles, Malcolm Abrams, was fired from there, and then they wouldn't take any more after that. I don't know why. I can imagine why, because they were really good articles and strong articles. But now they do have printed this story. Of course, one reason they're printing it is they keep saying it's a KGB agent. If you say it's a CIA agent, you can't get an article printed. You can do the research, but you can't get those conclusions in the major media. And the Globe and the Star are still considered media when they reach every grocery store and every stand and liquor store around the country. But there is a picture of this attorney from Texas and Michael Eddowes and an article on the cremation of Lee Harvey Oswald. That part made the back of the article, just the back page, but it's very important. Pick up the Globe, and also the Star this week has information. Now, nobody would beat me to the story of these Oswalds. Sybil Leek, who I know, has written a thing on the Oswald doubles, but it's like her book, The Assassination Chain. There's a lot of disinformation there. They don't have the people write the Oswalds of where they were or when, and that's why I'm working on the book so quickly. It's taken a long time to do the research, but I'm working on it right now. Michael Eddowes had an article last week saying that the grave has already been disturbed. I might have mentioned that to you, that he went out to the Rose Hill Cemetery and there was evidence that dug up earth around the headstone. Well, you couldn't pull nothing out of a headstone, so that doesn't mean much. But he noticed that the turf, more than 4 feet of it, had been removed around the headstone for whatever that's worth. Or maybe they would say, well, we cremated and put the ashes in the headstone. It'd be hard to tell a KGB man from a CIA man by the ashes. But keep up with that story, because that will be developing also, along with the other information about the Howard Hughes, the changes from Howard to Vance Cooper, and also the Hitler story, which will be evolving for years, and the Oswald story. Those are my favorites, and I work on them all the time. And I like to see them break out in the news. There was mention of Will Rogers in the news this week, and I just thought I would make a few comments as an aside, away from the other assassinations, but maybe a conspiracy. I wasn't aware of that until I went to L.A. to help work with a book, and somebody brought up the subject of Wiley Post and his competition with Howard Hughes for the world's flight record. And just at the time that Wiley Post had this record or was competing for it, he had this airplane crash up in Alaska. I wasn't very conspiratorial-minded years ago, and it would be too late to find out now, but the suggestion was made to me when I was in Los Angeles to check out the Wiley Post story. That was close to us because that airplane crash was in 1935. My father had a weekly radio program on KHJ in Los Angeles down on 7th and Bixell Street, and we went there every week, every Sunday night, and all went out to dinner. And after his show, he had a half-hour show. Will Rogers had a Sunday evening show. And so I used to see Will Rogers every week. I felt close to him. I mean, I grew up and remembered a lot of Will Rogers. Maybe that's where I got my cynicism in politics. In those days, looking back, 1935, I was 13 years old. But 11, 12, and 13, I used to see and hear Will Rogers a lot. And he was down at the radio station. As a matter of fact, we went to Alaska that year. We went up to the Arctic Circle, up to Fairbanks and Juneau. And Will Rogers and his family were going to take the train with us. We took the train to Seattle and then took a boat and went up to Alaska. And his family, he was going to go with us on that trip. And then they changed their mind and decided to fly. And he decided he'd fly up there with Wiley Post. And our family, my mother and father and my brother and myself, took the train. And the rest is history. That was the end. We never saw the family, any of his family after that, or anything kept up with Will Rogers' family. But we used to see him on the weekends up to that time, and we're going to take a trip together. It's hard to believe they talk about the 100th anniversary of his birthday. That sounds so long ago, because I have instant recall of things going back to my childhood, and I remember these incidences and those times very clearly. So I got a flash this week when I was thinking of the plane crash of Wiley Post and the anniversary of Will Rogers, that maybe some of my political awareness even came in at a young age of being exposed to people like that. I remember when Thomas Mann was in our home, and I had the measles, and I was home from school, and he was there, and a refugee from Germany and a writer. And there were other artists and people that my parents knew that had come over, and I'm sure there must have been some undercurrent or impact that May was getting into her head, just seeing these people or hearing them talk. I don't know how much I got from them, but as I look back, I think it must have been some influence in my way of seeing things or perceiving the world. We have to update the Vatican finances. Those of you that have all my tapes on Pope Montini, the Milan Mafia, and Mr. Sedona, and the missing money of the Praline brothers, I call them the Pauline brothers, but the $22 million that was missing out of Philadelphia that went to Poland, and then this Pope, 17 days after he became Pope, covered that up. I've done tapes on the missing money, the Vatican deaths linked to organized crime, their banks in Milan, and the recent deaths in the investigation of Sedona. Three people have now died. An article this last week, $18 million annual deficit cited in the Pope's report on Vatican cash. I laughed because I figured out that they'd been missing this money or reinvesting it since 1972. So if you took $18 million a year, that's what I figured out they've been missing, $90 million plus. So I wasn't invited to their meeting, and I'm not a very good bookkeeper, but I can almost figure to the dollar where their money is going and how they're missing it. They're having this special meeting, and they're talking about their deficit, but I don't think that the Vatican is going broke. And remember when the Pope came over here and he had the smile and raised his hands and spent the $7 million for the platforms and all the PR, and I dedicated that one Pope to the corruption of the money in the Vatican to show how on the front he has his overt surface of calm, but underneath he had already arranged for the College of Cardinals to meet to talk about the probing of their finances. And that is the most important, one of the most important stories going, because not only is the money siphoning out, being invested into American corporations and into organized crime and now linked to narcotics traffic and so forth, some way they're going to have to cover up before the young Catholic activists demand an accounting of the cardinals and what's going on with the money. In the San Francisco Chronicle yesterday on the financial page, there's an article, business section, Solution for the Vatican, and a Sister Teresa from San Francisco, Sisters of the Presentation, was upset because she was disappointed that certain money rates weren't printed, and she wanted them in the daily paper. And this columnist went on to say, what a difference this is when Sister Teresa writes letters, you know, that she wants the booking, the banking accounts in the column so the church can keep up with what's going on with money handling and business affairs, and they're losing $18 million a year. He thought it was quite a change for a nun to keep up with the finances from San Francisco, from the streets of San Francisco. And then the article said, several years ago, Fortune magazine rated the world's best managed institutions as General Motors and the Vatican. Motors was one and Vatican number two. Today, the Vatican would rank slightly above Chrysler. Well, this is what you call, again, Emerson's law of compensation, of sleazy people meeting with sleazy bums, getting out of the offices of religion, writing passports for Nazis, paying each other off to hide each other's crimes, getting into narcotics traffic, and taking huge amounts of Vatican money invested in American corporations, the great America get-rich-quick system. Well, they can lose their money like anybody else, and instead of keeping clean and running the Vatican as a religious institution, they've gotten tangled into investments in abroad, in Paris, Europe, the United States, and now they find they have the right to go broke like anybody else, which is pretty funny. This article says, Sister M. Rose Teresa, he says, Sister of the Presentation, she's interested in money, in market rates, in federal fund rates, in the euro-dollar overnight rate, and rates for commercial paper. And the author says, what esoteric interest that Sister Teresa wants to keep up with the financial posture of the Vatican. And it is pretty humorous how she wants an update every day in the newspaper so they know how their investments are going. Maybe she wants to know if she'll have a job or food the next month. Who knows? There's an article in the New York Times, October the 22nd, 1979, on organized crime and the Vatican money. It says Italian authorities have arrested a businessman named Rosario Spatola, 42 years old, in connection with the kidnapping of Michael Sindona. And those of you who don't have those tapes on Sindona, you'll just have to get those to update the kidnapping of him and the Vatican and this Pope John Paul II. The Italian authorities are investigating organized crime in Italy and in Sicily and in the United States that were involved in Sindona's disappearance. There's two theories that Sindona, he's the investment banker for the Vatican that brought their money to this country and brought millions from Europe, paid organized crime members to pretend he was kidnapped in order to avoid his trial date, or Sindona was in debt and he had organized crime members extract information from him of where he keeps large amount of money in Swiss banks, the Vatican money. He had been accused of taking $225 million from Italy to the United States and misappropriating $45 million of the Franklin National Bank in New York City in 1974. But there's also that $22 million that went over to Poland from Philadelphia that is missing. If you keep adding that up, $225 and $45 and another $22. Rosario Spatola was in New York for 3 weeks. The man that was recently arrested, he was in there. He owns a large construction company, a family visit, and he went to visit relatives and the aunt, Salvatrice Gambino, related to Carlo Gambino, the mobster that was killed 3 years ago. And he has a brother, this Spatola. Rosario has a brother, Vincenzo Spatola, 31, who's a Sicilian construction worker. And he was arrested. He had delivered a letter about Sindona's kidnapping to another man, a lawyer, by the name of Rudolfo Buzzi, and they sent these messages having to do with Sindona's disappearance when he was missing in New York City and was to come to trial and all his missing money. These letters were going back and forth in postmark to go to Vienna from Milan, Italy, and had to do with Sindona. Now, there's a man in Italy by the name of Rosario DiMaggio. You won't remember most of these names, but I think they're interesting. He's one of the foremost leaders of organized crime in Palermo, Italy, and he's the father-in-law of Rosaria Spatola, who was in contact with Sodona and that gang. And when the police went to search his farm to get information about this family of organized crime and the Vatican money, Rosario died of a heart attack. It says right after the police were there, he died of a heart attack. So that is the third person linked to the Vatican money and organized crime that has died since July that is aware of this investigation. Now, that must have the Pope plenty nervous with all this money floating around. And once you begin to pay off people in organized crime, the payoffs never stop and the church could go broke forever. The Spatola construction company in Italy that was involved with St. Michael Sindona and this banking case is run by these brothers headed by Rosario Gambino, who is the nephew of Carlo Gambino. The long article in the New York Times, and I'm surprised it was in the New York Times, we didn't get it out here in California at all on Sindona, speaks of his abduction and organized crime, and we're not getting anything on the wire services. San Francisco Examiner, the San Francisco Chronicle, LA Times is getting nothing about the death. We're only getting a message that the Vatican is having trouble missing $18 million a year, but nothing about the organized crime connections, which is really shocking. This one article, Italian officials link businessman seized last week to the Sindona case, and it's very clear of the organized crime connections to the missing money and also the deaths of these witnesses. Now, the Pope is getting a lot of PR. In spite of all that, they're selling records on the Pope, books on the Pope. There's an article last week, Pope John Paul meets Henry Kissinger. Right after he came back from the United States, he had a private meeting with Nazi Kissinger. Another article, the Pope plans to visit Brazil and the Philippines, two of the most terrible military dictatorships put in, but with a lot of Nazi money and a lot of control over the entire populations. He's going down next to visit them. And another article, America warned about Marcos in the paper. The people in Hong Kong are warning the United States that they should not coddle Ferdinand Marcos anymore or we'd lose our American bases. The United States is coddling a dictatorship against the people. That was in the United Press. Now, that's what I think, that if the Pope's going down there and Marcos is an embarrassment, I think he can go to Brazil and down to the Philippines and pick up millions of dollars that the Vatican is missing to support his regime. But you can't go to the countries that are poor and starving, so he has to go to the military dictatorships. And that, again, is where the compensation comes in and the fun and games of the balances now, because either they're going to outright kill, like the president of South Korea, just kill him and say, yes, we did it, or they're going to have to put in some semblance of governments, because in Iran, where the masses of the people are turning anti-American, add it up, and what would happen if 20 or 30 Americans were killed in these various countries, or these countries are overthrown, and we have nowhere to go? We've sent all these arms and weapons, and then they would be used against us. This is a very good possibility, and it's something that I believe are the counter forces that are taking place today. While there's a lot of turmoil, as I say, there's a lot of reaction. You have somebody as secure as the Shah of Iran, who's immovable, who has all these $22 billion he brings out of their families all over with $14 million, $10 million, $6 million, and there's no place to go, and there's no home, and he's out by this weird, funny-looking Khomeini who appeals to the people. Now, I hear on radio talk show they say that he's a dictator, that there's no radio, no rock music, no theater. People can create their own street theater. Years ago, there was none of that, and that's when the revolutions could get started and people could begin thinking. You look at the Pope and the Vatican that was second to General Motors, and they have to have a meeting from all over the world because they're losing $18 million a year and they're linked to all this sleazy business. This is the counterforce. And even this movie, the Summa Corporation took these films or tried to take it, and the movie couldn't come out. Now it's going to come out. The Hitler story will come out. There are these counterforces working. I am the eternal optimist. I keep this work up because I like to do it, and I think in our lifetime we will see progress. Psychic power and energy and truth are on our side. We have nothing to hide. You have a good time this week, and I'll be back with you next week. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California.